This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, dealing with the financial aspects of Boomerang Kids. Joining me in the studio now, Ephraim Zuroff is director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Israel Office and Eastern European Affairs Division and coordinator for Nazi Crimes Research Worldwide. In 2002, he launched Operation Last Chance, a public campaign to locate and bring to justice the worst suspected Nazi criminals before ill health or death spared them from potential punishment. Today, Zuroff is considered the world's preeminent Nazi hunter. He's also author of the book Operation Last Chance, One Man's Quest to Bring Nazi Criminals to Justice. He and Sarah Weiss, executive director of the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education, join us to discuss finding justice 70 years after the Holocaust. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sarah and Ephraim, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Ephraim, tell me about the work that's being done by the Simon Wiesenthal Center.
Well, the Simon Wiesenthal Center is involved in many different activities. Nazi hunting is only one of them. But if you allow me to focus on my own area of expertise, we're basically trying to facilitate the prosecution of Nazi war criminals who have never been brought to justice. And our job basically has three aspects. People ask me, you know, what do you do? What's your job? I say one-third detective to find the people, one-third historian to help find the evidence to build a case against them, and one-third political lobbyist, because many of the countries today do not want to bring these people to justice. And the best way to explain why is to compare a serial killer to a 90-year-old Nazi. In other words, if a serial killer were on the loose here in Cincinnati, I can promise you that the police would be doing everything possible to make sure this person is caught and put away so that he can't harm anybody, because the likelihood is that he will strike again. But what are the chances of a 90-year-old Nazi war criminal killing anybody? Basically zero. So in other words, the country's understand that all they have to do is wait it out, ignore people like me at the Wiesenthal Center, and they'll spare themselves the embarrassment, the expense, and the whole mess that a Nazi war crimes case trial could cause.
So are you saying there's just not the political will to pursue these things?
Correct. Exactly. No, there are countries in which there is political will. In Germany today, there is abundant political will to pursue these cases now. Okay, but if you compare Germany and Austria, which is, I think, a fair comparison, in Austria, they have not successfully prosecuted a Nazi war criminal in more than 30 years. And it's not because there are no Nazis in Austria, but the political will is not there.
Sarah, talk about why the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education has brought Ephraim into Cincinnati to talk on Sunday, is it?
Correct. So this week, really, and into Sunday, we're marking Yom HaShoah, or Holocaust Remembrance Day, which was actually officially yesterday, the day that is set aside initially in Israel and really accepted around the world to remember the victims of the Holocaust. And so our community-wide commemoration is this Sunday, April 19th, 2 p.m. at the JCC. And we brought Dr. Ephraim Zuroff to speak about why justice matters 70 years later. So our whole focus this year has really been on 70 years later, as you know, with the liberation of the camps and starting with the exhibition at the Freedom Center. And so we're pleased to have Ephraim with us to share his insights into that.
How did you start your career as a Nazi hunter?
Well, my first official job as a Nazi hunter was with the Office of Special Investigations of the U.S. Department of Justice, which was a special office set up by the DOJ to deal with the cases of Nazi war criminals who had emigrated and were living to the United States and were living in the United States. And I worked as a researcher in Israel for them for 6 years. And my job was to find Holocaust survivors who could be potential witnesses and to find any background material on the places where the criminals living in the United States had committed their crimes and any documents that could in any way implicate the people who were being under investigation in the United States.
So was any of your family killed during the Holocaust?
I'm actually named for one of the victims of the Holocaust, my mother's uncle, Rabbi Ephraim Zahr, who was murdered, as well as his wife and two children in Vilnius, apparently by Lithuanians. And I actually was supposed to have another name. And my parents had chosen a name. And when I was born, my father sent the cable to his father-in-law, who was in Europe actually helping the survivors of the Holocaust. And he told him that my mother had given birth to a boy. And my grandfather sent the cable, suggest name him Ephraim. Apparently, he had confirmed that his young brother, he was the youngest of six boys, had indeed been murdered during the Holocaust.
Now, what led you to launch Operation Last Chance? And how exactly does that program work?
Operation Last Chance offers financial rewards for information that will help facilitate the prosecution and punishment of Nazi war criminals. And the idea for Operation Last Chance was of Arya Rubin, who's a philanthropist living in Miami and a close friend, who felt that we had to be more proactive in trying to get information that could bring prosecutions or facilitate prosecutions. And it was launched already in some 13 countries and brought in a lot of names, a lot of suspects, because what you have to understand, one of the problems that we face, because we're working so many years after the Holocaust, is that normally when police try to determine who committed a crime, they start with that crime, then they try and see who committed the crime. But if we were to work that way, we'd end up wasting most of our resources and time, because between 98 and 99% of the people who committed the crimes of the Holocaust are already dead. So we have to start with a suspect who perhaps, a suspect alive and well enough to be brought to justice, who may have been indeed a criminal who's worthy of prosecution. That's a very hard way to work.
Mm. It sounds like it. So much time has passed.
Right.
Yeah. Now, how many countries are participating in this operation?
We've launched Operation Last Chance in 13 different countries. And but in effect, it's open to anyone anywhere in the world who can send us information. And if that information ultimately results in a prosecution, then that person will get a financial reward.
Are there any countries that have proven to be more difficult in doing this? They're less cooperative or any? Say, yes, there have been. There have been plenty. I mean, I know you talked about the lack of political will in a lot of places. And are there particular places that are more difficult than others?
Yes. I would point specifically to Austria, for example. And I'll tell you an amazing story. One of the ways that we publicize Operation Last Chance is to put ads in newspapers. And perhaps the most painful ad that I ever paid for, it was painful to pay for the ad, was in a newspaper called the Kronenzeitung, which is a very right-wing newspaper in Austria. And, of course, if you want the ad to have any effect, it has to be in a newspaper read by people who know Nazis. Okay? So, in other words, if I had put it into the Austrian equivalent of the New York Times, I would have felt very good, but no one who knew Nazis would read it. So, in any event, we put the ad in, and several weeks later, I get a letter in Jerusalem, in my office, from a woman who said the following: I am sick of the Holocaust denial and neo-Nazis in Austria. I want you to know that one of the monsters of the camps is living at Schiffmüllerstrasse 100 in Vienna. Her name is Erna Wallisch. I don't know if she's ever been prosecuted, but I want you to know that this woman exists. Okay? Now, so there are a couple of things we have to check. First of all, we have to check, is there really a woman named Erna Wallisch who's alive and living at that address? So you know what a pretext call is. You call someone up to ask if they want to buy insurance or use a car or something
right.
like that. Okay? So there is an Erna Wallisch. Okay? She's living at Schiffmüllerstrasse 100. Then comes the harder part. Was she indeed one of the monsters of the camps? And I had a wonderful researcher in Germany, Dr. Stefan Klemp, who found relatively quickly that she had served in Ravensbrück, which was an important concentration camp in northern Germany. But even more important, she had served in Majdanek, which is a death camp in Poland. But then another question arises. Was she perhaps already put on trial? And there were two trials of Majdanek personnel held in Germany. So we checked, and it was very interesting. It turns out she had not been prosecuted, but she had been investigated. And in the course of her investigation, she had related that she had taken people to be gassed in the gas chambers of Majdanek. Now, so listen, I have to tell you quite honestly.
My chin just hit the ground. That's amazing. Go ahead.
Listen, so I'll tell you what happened. So first of all, I have to tell you, I was very excited about this for two reasons. One is, as I told you, Austria hadn't prosecuted anyone mm-hmm. successfully for many years. And the second reason, Sarah, excuse me, yeah. was that she's a woman. And it was obvious that a case of a woman guard right. would get a lot more attention and publicity than the case of a man, because there are far more male concentration camp guards than women.
Right.
So I sent all the material to the Austrian ambassador to in Israel, and he passed it on to Vienna. And I made a meeting with the justice minister at the time, Karin Gastinger, and I went into the meeting for the first time with Austrian officials feeling pretty good, pretty hopeful, optimistic, etc. We sit down at the meeting, and the justice minister turns to me and says, Dr. Zuroff, I want to tell you that we cannot prosecute Erna Valesh. I go, why not? She took people to be gassed.
Mm-hmm.
Says, no, Dr. Zuroff, you don't understand. In Austria, what she did is considered passive complicity in genocide. So I'm like thinking to myself, this is unbelievable. What do you mean passive complicity in genocide? She shot seven people while watching television. I mean, that's absurd. It's patently absurd. So obviously, at that point, I realized we had run into a very serious obstacle. So I went to the Polish Institute of National Memory, which is an organization which deals with all aspects relating to communist and Nazi crimes. In other words, commemoration, research, and prosecution. And I explained to them, listen, gentlemen, you are well aware of the fact that the Majdanek death camp is in Poland. Erna Valesh committed her crimes on Polish soil, and she took people to be gassed. So they said, okay, we'll try and help you. Now, 9 months went by, approximately 9 months, and they found they were able to find, they have a staff of 1,000 people, far more than the Wiesenthal Center has, mm-hmm. okay? They found five witnesses who remembered Erna Valesh and that Erna Valesh had beaten inmates in Majdanek. Now, but the real kicker was this. Why did they remember Erna Valesh? Because Erna Valesh got pregnant in Majdanek. In other words, she did one thing during the day and another thing at night. Now, but think about it for a minute. Because she punched someone, there was a chance that she could be prosecuted. But if she just took them to be gassed, you couldn't be prosecuted in Austria. So the Austrians, in the wake of the discovery of the five witnesses, had to reopen the case. Once they reopened the case, there was an onslaught of the media trying to get pictures of Erna Valesh and, you know, interviewing the neighbors. I don't know if you're aware of this, but every Nazi war criminal who's exposed has neighbors who think he is a terrific guy or a terrific gal.
Well, that's the case a lot of time with the criminals. He seems like such a normal guy.
You know? Right. Of course, he mowed his lawn every week. It was just wonderful, you know. In any event, so the Austrians reopened the case. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, Erna Valesh died.
Oh.
Listen, I have to tell you one thing. I'm the only Jew in the world who prays for the benefit of the health of Nazi war criminals.
We will continue our conversation with Ephraim Zuroff and Sarah Weiss, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guests this afternoon are Ephraim Zuroff, considered the world's preeminent Nazi hunter, and Sarah Weiss, executive director of the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Lou in Dayton, Ohio. Good afternoon, Lou. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Yes. Mark, I'd like to ask your guest, why didn't the Israeli agents ever capture Joseph Mengele?
Okay.
That's the big question.
That's one of many big questions. Israel actually tried to catch Mengele during the operation in which Adolf Eichmann, the person in charge of the details of the implementation of the Final Solution, was kidnapped in Buenos Aires. And the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, knew that Eichmann had been living in Buenos Aires, but it turns out that he had fled Argentina several weeks before Eichmann was captured, and his new whereabouts were not known. Later on, the Mossad tried to track him down. It was unsuccessful, and at a certain point, the Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, took the people who were on this project for another more pressing issue, and ultimately Mengele died of a heart attack, drowning in the ocean near Sao Paulo in 1979.
Is there any estimate on how many Nazi war criminals could still be alive?
Okay, to be perfectly honest, no one really knows. But I have to say that the most dramatic development that has affected our issue is the extension of life expectancy. In other words, if 70 years after the Holocaust was in 1920, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But with the extension of life expectancy, people are living longer. And I sometimes half facetiously say people without a conscience maybe live even longer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Only the good die young.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Something
that
kind like of
thing.
That. Yeah. Less stress, you know? Yeah. No yeah. conscience, less stress. So many of these people live in countries with very developed medical services, like in Germany and Austria and places like this. So people are reaching a very old age, some of them in good health. And I'll just to give you one example. Three and a half years ago, I was informed about the presence in Budapest of a 96-year-old Nazi war criminal who was the commander of a large ghetto in the city of Košice, which was today Slovakia, then under Hungarian occupation. He was very active in sending 15,700 Jews to be murdered in Auschwitz. He was still driving his own car when someone gave me a tip through Operation Last Chance, and we brought this information to Hungarian authorities.
Paul called, and he wanted to know, were there any other Nazi criminals found other than John Demjanjuk, who were from this area, from the Midwest?
From the Midwest, I'm not sure. I don't know. But Demjanjuk was one of, you know, hundreds of Nazi war criminals who were found living in the United States. Most of them lived in the large cities in the eastern seaboard initially when the search began, and later on they were living in Florida. A lot of them. Now, of course, the irony of this is that many of the survivors of the Holocaust who came to the United States were living in urban centers in the east, or let's say east of Chicago. And they also, many of them, later moved to Florida.
We also had a call from Melanie who said, or she emailed, actually. She wanted to know if a Nazi criminal is found, but now incapacitated, do you still try to prosecute them?
We can't prosecute them because they can't be tried on medical grounds. So because of their medical condition.
So what's the tough? Is this really research intensive, Ephraim? Is that the biggest part of what you do?
That's certainly a big part of it, but there's also the detective aspect, and there's also the political lobbyist aspect. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of different facets. You need a lot. I have to say, to be honest, I need a lot of luck to be able to get someone into the docket and to be able to see that that person is convicted and punished.
Well, how successful do you feel that your efforts have been?
I don't know if it's my job really to assess it, but I can tell you one thing. I have to look at it. I can't allow myself to think about all the Nazi war criminals who were not prosecuted. We have to start from the basic assumption that it's very difficult to achieve success, and that there are six different levels of success for my efforts, okay? One is to publicly expose someone. Two is to get an official government investigation. Three is an indictment. Four is a trial. Five is a conviction. And six is a punishment. So mm-hmm. it's very difficult to get to six. But if we get, first of all, my experience has been that sometimes the most painful punishment for a Nazi war criminal is the exposure.
Yeah.
I'll never forget a case I had in Australia of a Hungarian who had murdered a 18-year-old Jewish boy named Peter Balasch, whom he caught without the yellow star in a streetcar in Budapest. And he knew he was Jewish because they had grown up in the same neighborhood. And this Hungarian army soldier murdered Peter Balasch and later threw his body into the Danube. And he ran away to Australia. And we were able to track him down. And what we did, we worked together with a local TV station, and they did a stakeout to see. In other words, I knew he was alive because we did the pretext call and all of this, but we wanted to see what his state of health was. So we made a deal with a local TV station. They did the stakeout, and they filmed him leaving his house and driving his car, which means he's obviously okay. Now, when they confronted him and told him about the accusations against him, so he denied it, but at a certain point when they completed the interview, they asked him, is there anything else you want to say? So he said, yes, don't tell my family. He's about to be exposed on national television. Don't tell my family.
Oh, my gosh. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Sarah, just why is it so important to keep this story out front?
You know, I think the question of justice and how do we find it after the Holocaust is a part of the history, is a part of the impact that is a must. It also, I think, Ephraim's work helps us have a better understanding of the history and also in other cases of genocide, we need to bring these perpetrators to justice in order to people to know that justice will be served in some way.
That's really one of the problems that we face. You know, in 1945, when the camps were liberated, the term "never again" was coined,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And I don't for a minute doubt the sincerity of the people who said "never again."
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, it's happened. Not the Holocaust. Things with right. some similarities to the Holocaust again and again and again and yeah. again. And part of the reason, in my opinion, is that it was not clear that if you participate in these crimes, you won't get away with it.
Right.
You'll pay very dearly for it. So the average person out there could say to himself, listen, you know what? I really hate these people, and I want to do something about them, and there's a very good chance I can get away with it.
So any idea since the operation launched back in 2002, any idea how many Nazis have been brought to justice through the operation?
Okay, I'll tell you exactly. We got the names from 2002 until 2011. We received the names of about 655 suspects, okay, in 42 different countries, believe it or not. But those 655 names yielded only 8 cases.
Hmm.
So that's just to give you an idea. It's a little more than 1%. But this is the obstacles or the circumstances that we're working under.
Aside from offering rewards, how do you encourage people to come forward with information?
Listen, sometimes the reward is an incentive. I have to say that the best information we received from people who didn't want rewards.
Mm.
In other words, the very existence of Operation Last Chance is basically a cry for help to the public. To anyone who has any pertinent information, to please contact us so that we'll be in a position to try and investigate and see whether this is ultimately can be brought to justice.
Sarah, can you fill us in one more time on the event that's happening
yeah.
on Sunday?
Our Yom HaShoah community-wide Holocaust commemoration is Sunday, April 19th, 2 p.m. at the Meyerson Jewish Community Center. All are welcome, and Ephraim will be speaking about why justice matters 70 years later.
Well, Ephraim and Sarah, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks
for having us.
Ephraim Zuroff is director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Israel Office and Eastern European Affairs Division, and coordinator for Nazi Crimes Research Worldwide. Sarah Weiss is executive director of the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education. Coming up, we'll look at ways to help your kids without wrecking your retirement savings. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.